It's time now for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings at this time, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger. Marshall's the editor and the publisher of the Timberjay. It's a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Morning, Marshall. Thanks for being here.
Well, happy to be here, Heidi.
Well, let's start off with a story you covered this week on mine hearings about withdrawals. Now, we're talking copper nickel mining, right?
Correct. And this is the proposal that was recently put out by the Forest Service. They're seeking a 20-year mineral withdrawal on about 225,000 acres of the Superior National Forest. And this is a fairly long established process, this withdrawal process. And as part of it, you go through a two-year period where there's a moratorium on any new mineral leasing while the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management undertake a study of kind of what the effects would be of a mineral withdrawal. And we had a similar study that was started in early 2017, which was very different. I mean, it really shows what a difference a pandemic makes. You know, last time we had this same hearing process, the same study, you know, they started out with public comment, and the public comment hearings that the Forest Service and BLM held back in 2017 were pretty raucous affairs, and they were attended by thousands of people. I mean, it was just amazing to see, you know, how kind of both sides in the debate, you know, for and against the mineral withdrawal, really mobilized their forces. And they were just packing any, you know, venue where they were holding these hearings. And, you know, they would come with signs, and they would come with colors, you know, different. They would wear specific colors. They had buttons, things like that. You know, so everybody was really making a big impression, I think. It certainly, as I was reporting it at the time, and it certainly was something you remembered. You know, that was a big experience, I guess. This time around, everything is on Zoom. And, you know, it was a very, very different experience. You would sit on your computer and, you know, various people would pop up and they would have their 3 minutes to speak their mind, and then they would go on to the next. And it was, I don't know, it just didn't have quite the same impact as the previous hearings had. But, you know, the interesting thing was a lot of the themes that people touched on were very similar. You know, opponents of the withdrawal were mostly representatives of some of the local governments. You know, we had the mayor of Ely weigh in, representatives from, like, the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools. We had a number of representatives from trade unions who spoke, you know, in favor, and they were mostly focused on, you know, the economic impact that they believe will come from the mine, you know, jobs in particular. And, you know, those opposed mostly, they weren't really representing, you know, groups per se. In most cases, they were just kind of speaking for themselves, and they were talking, mostly talked about the personal experience that they had had, you know, over the years in the Boundary Waters and kind of how it had changed their lives and why they thought it was important to protect the Boundary Waters from sulfide mining. And, of course, you know, this whole withdrawal, this area that they're looking at withdrawing from mineral leases is right on the edge of the Boundary Waters. It's kind of on the southern flank of the Boundary Waters near Ely. And, you know, this is an area that is upstream of the Boundary Waters. It's in the Rainy Lake watershed, or Rainy River watershed, I should say. And the concern there is that any kind of sulfide mineral development, copper nickel mining, you know, et cetera, would have an impact on water quality downstream, and that's obviously a concern when you're dealing with something like the Boundary Waters. You know, and a lot of the people who spoke in favor of the withdrawal, you know, indicated, you know, that water quality was a big thing, and that the fact that you could, you know, dip a cup in the lake and take a drink, that was a unique experience that's kind of iconic and associated with the Boundary Waters. So at this point, the public comment period on this withdrawal is actually closed now. It closed on Wednesday, and it'll be some months, I'm sure, possibly more than a year, before we hear much about this again, and that would probably come when the administration decides whether or not it's going to move forward with a 20-year withdrawal. And, you know, the interesting thing about it, you know, a lot of people think that if the withdrawal goes through, it's like, well, mining's all done there. But, you know, 20 years is a pretty short time frame in terms of mine development. You know, it's taken Polymet 20 years, and they still haven't got all their permits finalized. So, you know, it's a lengthy process, and but certainly if there was a withdrawal in this area, it would impact Twin Metals to some degree. It wouldn't necessarily suspend their existing permits. They do have two permits, and any valid existing rights would not be affected by this withdrawal. But those leases are under challenge, so they could still be withdrawn pending a future decision by the administration. And that decision could come relatively soon, possibly even this month. So we're going to be following that closely.
You know, in the past, because, of course, we've been covering this for how many years, one of the things I know you cover is also sort of the business side of this, whether Twin Metals, you know, say everything, they were able to start a company. Do they have enough investors? Is it a, would the business be able to go?
Well, of course, they have a big investor, per se, I mean, so to speak. I mean, they're, Twin Metals is a subsidiary, essentially, of Antofagasta, which is a huge Chilean mining company. I mean, Antofagasta certainly has the financial resources to undertake mining here. The big question is, you know, whether a mine there, the mine plan that they have proposed, is financially viable. You know, the one thing that, I mean, even a large company isn't going to undertake a project that is not going to be profitable. And at this point, they have not issued any financial analysis of their mine plan. And that's unusual. I mean, I know when Polymet submitted their mine plan or first published their mine plan, it came with, you know, a quite detailed financial projection. And we haven't seen that yet, you know, on the Twin Metals project. And to me, until that comes out and shows that there's some, you know, profitability here, I've been kind of, you know, skeptical about the whole project.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see another copper nickel mine proposition pop up in taconite, and announcement recently that Tesla already has a contract with them, and they are just beginning the process. So it'll be interesting to watch what's happening with all of these.
No doubt.
Well, let's move on to a story that we're hearing across media. In fact, we talked with Senator Tina Smith yesterday about staffing shortages when it comes to public health workers. You're covering that locally. What's happening in terms of Cook and their ambulance crew?
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're, we're just reporting this week on a story that we've been covering, you know, periodically, and that's that there are significant problems staffing rural ambulances. I mean, I know the Tower has certainly had problems with theirs. Cook has had problems, so has Orr, you know, and those are the ambulance services that we're dealing with up in our neck of the woods. And, you know, it's been an ongoing thing. And, you know, the problem is under state law, these ambulance services are supposed to maintain at least two staff on call at any time. Now, if they live within 10 minutes of the hall, they can, you know, they can remain at home while they're on call. But, you know, for folks who are further than 10 minutes away, in many cases, they're supposed to be either at some quarters that are provided for the ambulance staff, or they're supposed to be at the hall. And yet, you know, in many cases, the ambulance services, you know, really can't afford to be paying people very much to be on call. And in fact, you know, Cook, for example, they pay $3 an hour for an emergency medical responder, which is somebody with kind of a lower level of training. They can drive, you know, they can assist if they're, you know, working with patients or drive the ambulance, which is mostly what they do. And then they have EMTs, and they're making $4 an hour when they're on call. But of course, in most cases, they're not actually doing anything. They're just, you know, waiting to be, you know, in case of a call out. So, you know, they can, especially if they're able to be at home, they're able to, you know, undertake their, whatever they're doing. They can be watching TV or working on whatever they want to do, as long as they're ready to respond. But, you know, it's interesting. They're still having, you know, big problems finding people who are willing to do that. And being on call is a big, you know, thing. You know, it takes away time. You can't do things you necessarily want to do. It certainly limits your ability to travel. And, you know, for whatever reason, they're having tougher and tougher time finding people who want to undertake this. They're looking at trying to increase the rate of pay a little bit. They're talking about adding $1 an hour to the on-call pay. Unlikely that would make much difference. In fact, you know, Tower's struggling, and their on-call pay is like the highest in the state. And they're still struggling. I mean, it ranges about $11 an hour, and they are still, you know, having a hard time staffing. So, yeah, I don't think pay is necessarily the issue. A lot of it's just time. You know, people are busy with a lot of other things, and there just isn't quite that same mentality, or I shouldn't say, just the idea of public service is certainly not as prevalent today, I think, in our communities as it used to be, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was the hope during the pandemic that we would understand who the essential workers are and what we need, and people we kind of just take for granted, like school bus drivers and ambulance drivers. But I think we did momentarily, but a lot of people are just back to normal.
Yep, no doubt.
Well, let's move on. I want to hear about a study that you profiled in the paper from the University of Minnesota about moose, deer, and wolves.
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting study that was focused in, you know, the far tip of the Arrowhead, more in the Cook County area. And they were looking at how, you know, the interactions of deer, moose, and wolves. And the interesting thing that they pointed out was this may actually be one study that suggests that maybe the presence of wolves and pressure from predation may actually have at least one benefit to moose in northeastern Minnesota, and that's that in areas where they found that where there was increased predation pressure from wolves, that it had the effect of essentially segregating deer and moose across their various habitats. And, you know, most of the year, moose and deer tend to live in separate areas because they have different habitat preferences. But in the spring and in the when they're sort of migrating, because they do actually have some, you know, travel patterns and migration that they, especially down along the North Shore, you know, they tend to go down towards the water in the winter and then they move inland in the spring and summer. And the study found that where there was increased predation from wolves, that it actually kept the moose and deer more separate than in areas where where there wasn't much wolf activity. And you might think, well, who cares? But it turns out, of course, as we've talked about before, that white-tailed deer are carriers of a parasitic brain worm, which is harmless to deer. But it has it's deadly to moose, and the whitetails expel this brain worm, which almost all of them have, and they will expel brain worm larvae through their feces, and then those droppings are fed upon by land snails, and then the land snails they ingest the larvae, and then moose accidentally ingest the snails as they browse, you know, in the forest. And that's how they end up picking up the brainworm from deer. And that whereas the brainworm will just kind of stay along the outer edge of a deer's brain and doesn't burrow in actually to the brain matter, in the case of a moose, it does. And eventually, as more and more of a moose's brain is consumed, it has greater and greater effects and it's many points or in many cases it proves fatal to the moose. And so that's been a big problem. In fact, one of the studies that was done by the DNR suggested that about 23% of adult moose mortality is from this brainworm. So this is a significant issue, and if the presence of wolves and predation from wolves is helping to, you know, keep moose and deer separate, there actually may be, you know, at least one positive aspect of the gray wolves in terms of their impact on moose. We certainly know, and we've reported before and talked about, I think, that the impact of wolves on moose calves is pretty dire. You know, it's definitely a huge cause of mortality for moose calves. But once a moose reach adulthood, the brainworm is certainly a big issue. And so if there's things happening out there, you know, that are helping to reduce that brainworm incidence, that's certainly beneficial. And it does show, I think, that, you know, that the relationships out there, you know, in the ecosystem are very complex. And oftentimes, you know, we have a fairly simplistic view, but that, you know, this is, I think, one study that shows that the impact of wolves on moose is a bit more nuanced than maybe we, you know, sometimes like to see it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That is the Border News Roundup. It's Marshall Helmberger. You can read and see more in his paper at timberjay.com. Have a great weekend. Wear layers, of course.
Hey, will do.
Okay. Thanks, Marshall.
Take care. Covered pot's gonna boil over. Rusty pot's gonna leak right out. Hurry up, it's time to eat.